Good morning, and thanks for tuning in to the morning show today. This is Wednesday, February 13th, and this is 88.5 KRFY Community Radio. It is the morning show. I'm Susie Prez, and today we will be presenting two segments to the morning show with two very different interviews, one during the 8 o'clock hour and the second one at 9 o'clock. The first interview will be a recorded interview with our District 1 state legislators, Senator Jim Woodward and Representative Sage Dixon. Chris Bessler and I had the opportunity to sit down for this interview last Saturday, February 9th, for a midterm legislative update and review. Very interesting. So stay with us for that. That's coming right up. And at 9, right here, right after Bird Notes, I'll be back live in the studio with Lissa DeFredis, volunteer and bereavement coordinator with Bonner General Health Community Hospice. Lissa will be talking about an upcoming special program that will be broadcast here at 88.5 KRFY. It's called Conversations About Living and Dying Well. This four-week series presentation will air each Monday at 8 a.m. starting next week, February 18th. So stay with us for part two of the morning show today to find out more about how this podcast series came about and what it will be covering. But first, how about the weather from the National Weather Service? I think we're getting a reprieve today. Currently, it's 27 degrees out, mostly cloudy today with a high of 34, light and variable winds becoming west around 5 miles per hour later in the morning. Tonight, partly cloudy with low around 18, north winds 3 to 7 miles per hour. And Thursday, 40% chance of snow, then chance of rain, snow. High of 35 with little snow accumulation. But then Thursday night, 80% chance of snow, low around 28, north winds around 8, and possible snow accumulation 1 to 3 inches, but nothing like we just had. I don't know about you guys, but I've been shoveling quite a bit lately. And now this is a new segment on the morning show. It's called the Sandpoint City Minute. And we heard from Jennifer Stapleton last night, and she'd like us to let you know, beginning at 8 a.m. on Wednesday, February 13th, motorists crossing Bridge Street between First Avenue and City Beach will be rerouted through Gunnings Alley. Flaggers will be on site to direct the two-way traffic. Access to Gunnings Alley is via Main Street. The majority of the south wall of the fire-damaged building at 202 North First Avenue will be removed in order to protect public safety. The wall has been determined to be structurally deficient. Demolition work will be performed by Earthworks Northwest under contract with Liberty Mutual Insurance, the insurer of the building. Portions of the work may extend to the building wall along First Street as well. Investigation into the cause of the fire is continuing by the Idaho State Fire Marshal, and he has been on the scene from Boise over the past few days. Fencing will be erected along the building at 202 and 204 and 6 North First Avenue later in the day. Once the demolition has been completed, the parameters of the fencing will be finalized to protect the scene from ongoing investigation, as well as public safety in and around the area. That was your Sandpoint City Minute. And now, here is the recorded interview with District 1 state legislators, Senator Jim Woodward and Representative Sage Dixon. And remember, stay with us for a 9 o'clock interview with Bonner County Hospice. Thank you, Senator Woodward and Representative Dixon, for taking the time to join us today on KRFY for a midterm update. Let's start with a brief two-minute statement from each of you on your experience the first 6 weeks of session, particularly what committees you sit on and the bills currently active in those committees. Let's start with Senator Woodward.
Good morning. Thanks, Susie. You know, I'm serving on the Joint Finance and Appropriations Committee. So that's a committee that meets every day. It's the Senate Finance Committee, the House Appropriations Committee. We meet in a joint session Monday through Friday, 10 members from each body. So we have 20 people on that committee, and sit in the old Supreme Court courtroom in the Capitol. So it's set up with a little bit different than the regular committee room. But and what we've been doing the first 6 weeks, we've been through 5 weeks now and have one more week of budget presentations. So we go through every budget of every agency, department, and division in the state and look at what they've done in the past year and what we want to do with that agency, what the agency is requesting and what the governor is recommending on their budget. So the budget model we use in the state here is to have a base number. If the previous year budget had a one-time line item, we take that back out and go back to what's the base, and then make adjustments for inflation and for any other increased costs that are statutory increases. And then from that point on, then start to talk about what are the priorities and what do we want to do with this agency differently, or either to add to or subtract from their budget. So that's 6 weeks of budget presentations. And next week, we'll, at the end of this coming week, we will then make some decisions about where we want to be on budget forecast, along with a few other items to help set that the next budget. We have a constitutional mandate to have a balanced budget here in the state of Idaho. To have a balanced budget, you have to know how much money you have to spend, and we're predicting that out in the future. So we have to make some kind of forecast, a budget revenue forecast. And then with that, once we've all agreed on that, then we'll set a budget for all of these agencies to match up with that. And then in this year, then with a fairly substantial ending balance, because we know we have this uncertainty still about the withholding, the income tax withholding that we've spoken about before. And we also have Medicaid expansion that we have some pretty good numbers where we think we might be, but we also know from the experiences of states surrounding us when Medicaid expansion has occurred that sometimes the enrollment numbers and then therefore the costs are quite a bit higher than what was expected. So we've been, that's the budgeting process. And then I've also sit on the education committee. We're looking at the school funding formula.
Mm-hmm. Both of those, the Medicaid expansion and education, we'll get to with questions. So thank you, Senator Woodward, for an update.
I'm going to actually jump in with a question here because it's a good spot for it. The projection is that the individual income tax revenues are coming a lot lower than projected.
Yes.
How's that figuring into dealing with the whole figuring out how much money the state's going to have?
We still anticipate that the income tax paid to the state by us will true up at the end of the tax season. We know, we've been watching all along this year, that corporate income tax has been tracking where we expected, and sales tax is tracking where we expect it to. And looking at our economy, we know that we are not in a downturn right now. The economy is running strong, but it's that because of the 2017 federal tax changes, the 2018 Idaho tax changes, that the withholding allowances need to be changed by the employees now. And so that's created that situation where not as much money is being withheld. Although I do like to remind everybody that we did, prior to me being in the legislature, but Representative Dixon's part of that, cut taxes last year. We went from a 7.4% income tax rate in Idaho to a 6.925%. So there is a tax cut. So even if you're surprised at the end of the year that you owe some taxes when you go to your taxes, your total tax for the year will be less than last year.
Yeah, and this is, again, because of this withholding formula changed, and
yes,
people are going to, so beware, listeners, there might be a little surprise on your tax bill this year, but as you said, Senator Woodward, it's going to even out in the end.
It should. It'll even out. And it's a good time to remind everybody that the W-4s, we do now have a state W-4 form. We have the IRS form W-4 and a sheet and with a set of instructions to calculate your withholding allowance for the federal tax forms. And we have a separate form now with Idaho, and you will get a different number if you follow the instructions on that.
Well, thank you. And Representative Dixon, an opening statement. What have you been up to for 6 weeks or 5 weeks?
It's been an interesting 5 weeks. And good morning, Chris and Susie. Thank you for giving us this opportunity to update everybody. As I mentioned at our previous interview, this is my third term, and it's my third morning committee. I've been bounced around a little bit, and this year I'm serving on the Revenue and Taxation Committee. So there's a steep learning curve there. Pretty important committee, I think, next to JFAC. It's the second most important committee. And then, of course, our committee in the Senate that does the same thing. There's a lot of attention paid to that committee. So, but to learn the vocabulary and the trajectory of legislation, it takes a little bit. So I'm kind of learning things again, but I appreciate being on that committee. Still serving on the Transportation Committee in the afternoon. So this is my third term on that committee, and I enjoy that committee. We have not seen a lot of legislation. We dealt with a very thick packet, about an inch thick bill that was for the Uniform Code of Military Justice, because we also handle defense. It's transportation and defense. And so our National Guard group out of Idaho, they have to go through us when they need to change some things, and they're updating their Uniform Code of Military Justice. So that's kind of interesting. But we had a bill that dealt with UTVs. And there's a new model out there that looks like an old Willie's Jeep, but it's not allowed on the highway, so we're dealing with the weight of those vehicles. And we allow ATVs and on the highways in certain areas, like our area. Sometimes in Ponderay, you'll see an ATV shoot across 95 and going from one place to another. And so these just little bills like that right now. The odd thing about this year is there's not a lot of legislation compared to other years. In the House, we had basically 2 days where there were... no bills on the calendar, our reading calendar. And normally we have our second reading calendar, which is where they announce what bills are coming up. And the third reading calendar is when we actually vote. And I believe it was Wednesday. There was no bills on either one of those. So being a month into the legislative session and having no bills on the calendar is a bit strange. And I'm not sure whether that is due to the new administration with Governor Little or just the new legislators and nobody's running a lot of legislation. But it's an interesting dynamic this year that we're seeing. I also serve on the business committee. That's my third committee in the afternoon.
And you're the chair of that committee.
I am, yes. I was appointed chair of that committee, and that's been a different learning curve because it's more of a management position. I'm not necessarily sitting there looking at every line of a bill during the committee. I'm managing it and making sure people are able to ask their questions and everybody's behaving appropriately and things like that. And I do get to see all the bills before they come through the committee also to see if they're appropriate for my committee and give some advice to whoever's sponsoring that bill if I think it'll be heard well in the committee or if I think they need to do some structural changes and things like that. So I appreciate the trust the speaker and leadership have put in me in that position, and it's a little change of role on that committee, but I'm enjoying it so far.
Well, I suppose some folks would say fewer bills coming through the legislature is actually good. Smaller government, right?
Yes.
Sometimes I think people think that legislators are going down there just to pass laws. Right. But
so it's not a complaint. It's an observation. And I'm kind of happy with it.
Yeah, Senator Woodward.
I might add to that the Governor Little and his staff are working pretty hard at cleaning up a lot of regulations. That we heard in the State of the State, the idea that if you wanted to add a regulation, figure out how to get rid of two. And the governor has a young, aggressive, and smart person who's running his Division of Financial Management, who was very successful in one agency cleaning up the regulations because they always get added to over time. And at some point, you need to go back and revisit and just clean up. And so that... that person is now overseeing across the regulations cleanup.
So we might see more stuff later in the session as they work through this with a new governor and new staff.
That's possible, and a lot in the rules. As the House and the Senate, we write laws, and the governor signs those laws in. And then from those laws always come the agency rules, and cleaning up those rules is a big part of what's happening.
So some of the legislation we have seen is dealing with this reduction of regulations already, and that's been a big change on the business committee. My first 4 years, we were always trying to hold back on additional regulations, additional licensing requirements. This year, the rules that we've seen in legislation that we've seen is removing all these things and paring it down to the bare minimum of public safety and then what we need to do, or even removing some licensing and things like that. And that's been a very encouraging change for most of us. I think everybody agrees that there's too much. And so paring this down, it's nice to see that.
Yeah. Any individual rule, of course, can be contested as being important or not is the trick you guys have to walk down there to discern on that point.
And we were successful this week too with one rule in particular that affected Sandpoint and Panhandle special needs.
Yes,
and that Representative Dixon and I and former Senator Keogh met with Panhandle special needs at almost probably 6 or 8 months ago, mm-hmm. and understood the concern there. There was a rule which would really change the business model. And I learned at that time also what Panhandle Special Needs is doing here in the community. And so we were fortunate this week that because the system right now requires that both the House and the Senate reject a rule to stop that rule, we were able to, in the Senate Education Committee, we caught that and lined out one line of that rule change to so we can ensure that Panhandle Special Needs can continue to operate the way it does. House Education Committee, that same thing happened.
Yep, they concurred. So it passed the House Committee originally. Then when it went to the Senate, they rejected one line item in a rule that was very important for these folks that are serving the special needs community, adults specifically, giving them skills and jobs. And they were trying to... The Department of Vocational Rehabilitation doesn't like sharing some of these dollars. And when I was on JFAC and serving with Senator Keogh on that committee, we met with them and gave them some direction that they needed to put dollars towards these programs. And their answer to that was to go through the rules process when we weren't in the legislature and establish a rule that they wouldn't have to do that. And thankfully, Senator Woodward and his colleagues over there caught that rule. The House didn't. And through the education he got with Panhandle Special Needs and Trinity, the lady there that's constantly been giving us information, they rejected that rule in the Senate. Trinity sent me that information. I was able to go to my colleagues on the House the day of the hearing and tell them, we've got to stop this, and here's what happened. And it wasn't just that they're going around the legislature through the rules process, but it'll seriously affect businesses within our state, not just up here in Sandpoint, but there's about 20, 25 different businesses that need these dollars in that way. And so those are positive things. We're always happy when we can do that. And so that worked out very well.
Well, congratulations on catching that in the Senate and the House and making it possible to take care of that business aspect. One of the questions I have is when you both mentioned changing the rules in the Senate, changing it in the House, that both has to happen. So then it's just okay then. It can be done in the committee. It doesn't have to go to the whole floor.
Correct.
Changes to the rules,
right?
Not to law.
All the laws that we pass, as Senator Woodward said, when we come back home to our districts and reestablish our normal lives, then the executive branch or the bureaucracy starts writing the regulations for those laws that we passed. And that is the rules promulgation is the big word that we use there. That's when they go through and say, what do we need to do within our agencies to come into accord with what the new laws are? And they promulgate rules, and if there's a request of, I believe it's 25 people, they'll come to an area and hold a hearing. It's called negotiated rulemaking. So they're supposed to bring all the stakeholders together to discuss these rules and how they're going to work out. And then we have the opportunity to review those rules in the following legislative session. And we did a constitutional amendment 2 years ago to ensure that we had that right, because they are, in effect, law. And we need to make sure, as we just described, that they are enacting these laws through the rules process the way we intended. So that's our opportunity to do that. Now, the only difficulty is that it takes both bodies, as the senator said, to reject a rule. So sometimes we'll reject something in the House, and they can run over there and give a little bit different presentation to the Senate, and the Senate might not be communicating with us, or we might not communicate that with them, I should say. And then the rule goes through. One body to accept, two to reject. And that's something we'd like to change also, because then it goes into effect as law. But that's our rules process that we go through. First 3 weeks of every session, roughly.
Okay, so you guys have been busy on your respective committees, but do you see coming down the line, maybe not introduced yet, but some legislation coming up that might be of particular importance to people up here in North Idaho? Open question.
The school funding formula is what I'm certainly working on now. Sitting on the Senate Education Committee, we have a 60-page draft, and we're doing this process a little bit different than normal, because normally you don't see a bill until it is a bill. It's been printed by a committee. And in this case, we're working with a draft because we know that there's a lot to it. To change the school funding formula, which involves the the funding for the entire school system, the K-12 system we're talking about, but the transportation, any initiatives that are in right now in line items to spell out, like, for example, the career ladder for teachers, and every little piece that goes into the education system, then you have to try and capture that. And so the intent of this new funding formula is that we shift from an average daily attendance-based model where we just count heads every day and then money is appropriated across the state to all the school districts based on what the average daily attendance is, shift that to an enrollment-based model so that the funding more closely follows students. And a key part of that enrollment then is the idea of fractional enrollment, that some students may be homeschooling or taking classes at community college, or be in different institutions or different learning environments. Or actually, it's called a LEA, local educational agency, is the term in the proposed legislation and what we use now. So to change that funding formula so that the money can better flow to the students and what they're working on. Where we are in the process now is that we have a draft, and Thursday we had a joint session of the House and Senate Education Committees, and that was what we call the listening session, where we didn't answer or ask any questions. All of the stakeholders came into the big auditorium, and we listened as the school boards, the teachers, the administrators, the State Board of Education, the State Superintendent of Instruction, and everybody involved in this process came forward and shared their thoughts on this proposed 60-page piece of legislation to fundamentally change how we fund schools. It'll be a long conversation, and we'll head in next into our individual Senate Education and House Education Committees and start to make tweaks to this. There is no requirement to change it this year, but there's a fairly high probability that a bill will move forward. And the good thing is, though, that we're setting this up with quite a bit of overlap and time out into the future. So if we come up with a piece of legislation this year, it's a new funding formula, the next school year that we go into will still run based off of the existing formula, and yet we'll be able to, off to the side, as in shadow that and see what happens in that new proposed model, and still have one more legislative session then to fix or make tweaks.
So what is the response from different districts been to this funding formula? And I guess I'd add on to that, how does it affect our school districts up here in North Idaho?
Lots of different responses, in that everybody goes to the sheet. There's a great big Excel spreadsheet that has every school district in the state and has all the weighting factors. So the proposed funding formula is a base number for every student, and that currently is around $4,000 per student, and then with weighting factors applied, 10% for this. If you have remote rural schools like we do, and a little bit more to help add for transportation requirements, special education needs, gifted and talented, different weighting factors. And so because those weighting factors right now are just proposed, they get tweaked all the time, and a lot of people have seen different variations of this. And so there hasn't been an apples-to-apples comparison, and so we do have one day you might have somebody saying they're in the red, or in the next they might be in the black, depending on what you've done with that spreadsheet. The numbers that are in the draft proposed legislation for weight factors, we still come out just fine. And the other thing that is part of this is that we have a three-year hold harmless period to provide a transition. I think that where you'll see the schools that really are at a disadvantage in the new funding formula, one stands out in Orofino. There's a school that takes a student statewide who really had discipline problems. Do you remember the name of it? Challenge Academy, I believe. Okay, and it doesn't receive nearly the funding that it does now in the new model. Because it's such an outlier in this, and it's really not a traditional school, most likely we'll end up pulling it out of the model and funding it separately. It just doesn't fit this new model. There are a few others. Some of the schools that don't receive as much funding, maybe they have perhaps been taking to their advantage, very well utilizing the current system, because you can put in an account for different students who have different needs, and you get more money based in the, mm-hmm. the current system. And so if you're taking advantage of this current system,
fully utilizing
the current system, then you might see that you're not going to turn out as well. The biggest challenge I have right now with the proposed school funding formula is that it doesn't take into account alternative schools. And of course, I have a personal bias. My wife teaches at the alternative school, so I'll make that known. But I see the outcome or the benefit of alternative schools. And the big difference in an alternative school is the student-teacher ratio is 12 to 1. We fund it at a 12 to 1 student-teacher ratio versus a 20 plus to 1 ratio in the standard school. By doing that, some of the kids or students who haven't been able to move along in the normal school environment for many different reasons, and in a lot of those not necessarily their own fault, they're able to move forward in that alternative environment. We get some more kids out of school with a diploma and get them sent on to somewhere.
And become productive citizens.
Exactly.
That's the whole goal. Yeah.
That is it. And so we're working pretty hard to try and figure that one out.
Representative Dixon, and your take on education and the new funding.
Oh, well, I was on that interim committee for 3 years, so this is somewhat of a project close to my heart, and it's something that I thought we did a good job on, trying to involve everybody across the spectrum of stakeholders for 3 years, and specifically including our districts up here. Maybe not so much Bonner's Ferry. I didn't get a lot of response from that part of our district, but certainly West Bonner and Lake Ponderay have been involved in following this, and I would just concur with what Senator Woodward said. I think once we finally came forward with draft legislation and said this is what it's going to look like, then everybody kind of got a little shocked because it's a system that they're used to and knowing how to use it, not in a bad way, but just that they're comfortable in such a large system and the requirements they have to run it correctly within their individual districts. This is a big shift, and so there's a lot of concern going on, and I think we'll continue to hear that, and it will be not everybody's going to be happy. We've tried to, one of the terminology or terms is apply Band-Aids. Okay, if you have a problem, fine, we'll take care of this problem here. And then you have a problem, okay, we'll take care of that. But then it becomes too large and cumbersome the way it was before, and we're missing our point of streamlining it, trying to make sure that the money is following the child to where the child is being educated, and then giving the districts the leeway to fund the things that they need, not so many specific line items, which I think is really key in this legislation. So not being on the education committee anymore, I won't have as much of a role as Senator Woodward in shaping this, but I'm watching it and communicating, and when we get questions from our districts up here, we're sure to communicate that with those germane committees.
I noticed at the town hall last week, was it, or the week before, there was a question about the levy. And so I'm wondering where this new funding formula kind of maybe equalizes the need for a levy. Will there always be a need for levies, operation levies? Let's be clear. Has that been looked at?
I mean, that wasn't, that came up a little bit over in the 3 years that we had this interim committee, but that wasn't really our focus. Our focus is what is the base amount that we need to provide per child, and then what are the individual needs that we need to put weights to that cause districts to spend more money on certain children. And so that was our focus, is what is this, what do we need to provide to be uniform under our Constitution to each district or each individual or entity providing education, because you have the online schooling as well, and it's public schooling. So I've got some questions about that. This money won't follow you to a private school. At this point, it's just our public school system. So this won't address levies. It's not going to solve that problem, because that would take a whole lot more dollars. That's poor English, but just more than we can put in. And I think the individual needs of the districts, that's an opportunity for them to get what they need and for the citizens to say yes or no. And that's always a conversation that we come back to. And there's no clear solution at this point, unfortunately.
And if you're just tuning in, this is the 88.5 KRFY Morning Show with Chris and Susie as hosts. And we're talking today with State Senator Jim Woodward and State Representative Sage Dixon. And thank you guys both for being here again and taking time out. You just get a little chunk of time when you come back up, and then you got to get back down to Boise. And we appreciate your reaching out to communicate with your constituents like this. Representative Dixon, one, we got some specific questions, but I wanted to come back to that question I threw out that Jim answered. Do you see legislation coming, maybe outside of your committees, that you think is of particular importance to constituents up here in the northern part of the state?
Yes, and specifically the school funding formula would be one obvious one. And then what Senator Woodward and I talked about, again, just in that rules process. That wasn't legislation, but it's so important for us to get communication from people in our district. It's hard to see everything that's going on. So when there's something that does specifically affect our district, we need to know about that. And it worked out very well this time. It doesn't always work out perfectly, mm-hmm. but when we're able to add our voice to an issue, that's great. And the city of Sandpoint came to Senator Woodward and I and Representative Scott and expressed some concern about the next census. And because we are a resort city, there's the local option tax ability. And what Mayor Ronstadt and Administrator Stapleton were expressing to us is their concern that we will be over the 10,000 person limit for the population and that they would lose that ability. So we've been poking into that and trying to see what this might look like. It's not an easy conversation, especially in the House, because there's many members in the House and especially on the Rev and Tax Committee that don't like that local option tax. Mm-hmm. And I was warned, if you open this up, we're going to blow it up. Essentially, we're going to take it all away. So we're gingerly working through our options to try and provide that protection. If there's the will in the legislature, it's us and Haley at this point that are getting close. And I believe there's about 15 cities that have that resort city designation that can have the local option tax. And most of the other ones are far below population-wise. But that's our role as the representative and senator for this district and trying to make that work because, you know, again, not a lot of people like that. But at the same time, we see the dramatic effects upon the infrastructure here in Sandpoint and the need for that additional local option tax. So we'll see how that works out. But that's one that would directly affect the district here.
And I'll throw in on that the local people that live within that district have to vote in favor of it.
Correct.
And so it's not something that comes down from the state like that.
Yeah, I'd add a few more details on that tax. That the city of Sandpoint, we're talking about Representative Dixon and I, who are both Republicans and minimalists in government, but we're saying, yes, we'd like to have this tax. And I, at least for myself, then I can say the reason we're talking about having that resort tax or resort city designation that allows us to have some taxes. In this case, a hotel bed tax that we take advantage of here in Sandpoint, and that helps cover those events that we have during the year where we see a large influx of people. We have the festival, Lost in the 50s, events at Schweitzer. We have all these things that bring a lot of folks into town and put extra load on the infrastructure. That's the emergency services, overtime for the police, cleaning up the parks afterward when we have the arts and crafts fair at the beach. And so I think it's appropriate that we have that resort city, that local tax, because it allows us to, some of the people who are using those services then are the ones that are footing the bill instead of everybody here in town paying for the party.
Right.
Well, thank you. Did you want to say
something? Well, I was just going to say there's transportation issues. And when we came back last week for the town hall, I heard of another two or three accidents that happened along 95 in Sagal. And so we continue to push on that. And Senator Woodward brought up doing a speed study as far as maybe the speed limit, and they're doing that. But then they also sent me some information saying they're going to do a whole transportation study along that corridor from Dufort Road up into the Long Bridge. And they're aware of it. It's just not something that happens quickly because there's so many issues throughout the state.
And just so you know, the mayor, Ronstadt, and Administrator Stapleton were our guests last week, and they were really excited and grateful that you received them so well and were taking up their quest for that extension on the population on resort tax.
Oh, good. They've always been open with their communication about needs, and we haven't, I'll admit, seen eye to eye on certain things, but it's been always a good conversation, and this is one where I think we're trying to move on.
There's a lot of things that have come up, but one of the things we want to look at is the Medicaid expansion. In the general election, Proposition 2 passed, making Medicaid expansion the law of the land, and it's been signed by the governor. On February 5th, Idaho Supreme Court upheld the Medicaid expansion law by rejecting Idaho Freedom Foundation's suit, saying there was no basis for the suit. The majority of the court called the argument unpersuasive. So what's the next step to implement this law? It probably has to do around funding, but what can you tell us? Where are we going?
It is my understanding that the only thing that has to happen is to provide a spot in the budget for the Medicaid expansion. So in the Joint Finance and Appropriations Committee, that's what we're working toward. It's in the governor's budget. And so that doesn't mean that it's not, an individual legislator can is not prohibited from bringing forward a bill. And there's a lot of discussion. The catchphrase this year is sideboards on restrictions. And it's definitely, we've heard loud and clear that people voted for Medicaid expansion as proposed. The only thing that I would see that might be put in, I don't really see a work requirement, in my opinion, being put into place, but probably the idea of a sunset clause, just so that we have a chance, a sunset clause being that we fund it for a certain number of years and then force us to revisit, because we have a constitutional mandate for a balanced budget. And if we run into a financial issue because of the funding requirements being greater than we anticipate, then we still have to meet our constitutional requirement to balance the budget.
Conversation in the House has been very similar. Mainly what we've talked about is how the funding will look like, because that is the one thing we have to do. Haven't opened up a lot of conversation about what sideboards there may be. There's a group that gets together once a week, or have been for the past couple of weeks, that are trying to discuss what that might look like. But at this point, we're looking at what existing funding we have that could take care of what the initial projection was. And I'm uncomfortable with those numbers, and we know that we've spoke during the election season about these things. The sunset clause, I think, is a very important part of this, because if our enrollment does expand the way we've seen it expand in other states and it's costing us a whole lot more, we need to be able to step back and look for a different solution at that point. But this may be another reason why it's been kind of a quiet session, because everybody's waiting to see what's going to happen with this and formulating their ideas on that. Yeah,
I think another key part of that discussion, too, is to recognize that the Medicaid expansion, we're picking up two distinct groups of folks. We have had a Medicaid system since 1965, and there were certain requirements to meet that. So everybody and all of those people are below 100% of the federal poverty level in their income level. And so all of those people will be picked up by Medicaid expansion. We'll also, because the expansion part, another part of expansion is that the people eligible for Medicaid now can earn up to 138% of the federal poverty level. And so right now there are a group of people who have had tax credits available to them through the Affordable Care Act. It's anybody making between 100 to 138% of the people are on the Idaho Health Exchange. So about 20% of the people on the health exchange who are currently receiving as much as a $5,000 tax credit to buy health insurance privately will come off the health exchange and go on to Medicaid. And so the Affordable Care Act is fully funded at the federal level. And so we're picking up an obligation for that, the 20% of the people who are currently on the exchange. And they're the ones that are getting the bigger tax credit because they're at the bottom level of that sliding scale, the 100 to 400% sliding scale on the Affordable Care Act. So that 20% is coming into Medicaid. In Medicaid, in our state budget, we have that 10% match.
Yes. So that might inflate the numbers, make the numbers higher.
It has.
Yes. Well, on the other side of the ledger, though, there was some talk during the run-up to the vote that this would relieve some of the people that fall into indigent funding that the counties provide. Has there been any kind of analysis that we might see some relief for the monies that counties have to put in?
There's some talk of that, but if the counties are very worried that they're not going to have funds to take care of the people that aren't then on Medicaid expansion, because there's a certain portion of the population that'll still be needing that. It actually moves it up to people that have more resources, perhaps. And so we're getting a lot of pushback in the House from the counties to not take the CAP fund out of that, because they still see that they need it. So that changes that conversation a little bit, because that was portions of the indigent funds and CAP funds were what we were talking about in the House to fund this expansion at that $45 million Milliman estimate. But so that's changed now that we're in session and these conversations are going.
I want to define those terms just to make sure everybody understands that if you end up in the hospital and you can't pay your bill, the county will pay up to $11,000 on your bill there, and that's through the indigent fund at the county level. and then above $11,000 in debt that you can't take on, that you're not able to manage, the state pays that. And then there are repayment programs that go along with that. At the state level, we call it the catastrophic fund. And at this county level, it's the indigent fund. Word is that the indigent fund probably doesn't change much, and especially not during the transition period. But once we transition fully over a year, year and a half time frame, then the catastrophic fund at the state level, that fund requirement should come down.
Okay, well, let's move on to another subject here. Susie, do you have another question on that one?
No, it just sounds complicated. Good thing good people are working on it.
At the Environmental Forum on January 16th in Boise, our new governor, Brad Little, was asked a question from the audience, how is the state adapting to climate change? And his response was that, you know, quote, climate change is real, and he thinks the solution will come from financial market forces, meaning by free competition between the energy companies and financiers like bankers will be looking to finance projects that have smaller carbon footprints. That's kind of the short description of that. But the question is the governor or the legislature advancing any bills or policies to address the effects of climate change, regardless of how climate change is coming about? Is the state taking any proactive action to figure out what are we going to do if we have more fires or these other effects we see from climate change?
Not that I've heard in the House. I think there may be some personal bills, which is a certain tactic used generally by the minority to put their issues forward, but they don't get hearings. And it's kind of used to say, well, it's more used in election years to kind of say, look what I did for you, to go back to your constituents. And some people use that still to get the issue out and be a point of argument. So I haven't heard of it, but there could have been something that one of the minority party members had written as a personal bill. So it may have a bill number. But because those go around the committee process, and one of our initial filters as a legislature, those generally don't get hearings, and that just becomes a different debate. So I've not heard anything specifically about climate change and trying to help with the effects on our economy. The wildfire issue, in my opinion, a lot of what we're working on is the Good Neighbor Authority and better forest management practices to remove a lot of the undergrowth and dead trees that are out there to help with the fuels issue there. There's a bill that came through my committee that is tangentially related to that, and it deals with allowing solar panels in HOAs, in developments that have an HOA, and the HOA administrators may say, no solar panels on your roof. So this bill came through, and we had a print hearing. We haven't had a full bill hearing yet, but I thought there was merit to it. It's your property. If you want to put a solar panel on your roof, you should be able to. Mm. But we'll see how that goes.
So the state can override a homeowner association
something
like that?
We put it into effect. We can shape what they're allowed to do as a homeowners association. And there's an issue. If I enter into a contract, I know what I'm getting into, and should I be able to abrogate that contract? Mm-hmm. And I would say no. So we'll see what this discussion turns into. But that's just a tangential issue to what you're describing.
Yeah, well, we see all these little tentacles going out of dealing with this larger issue.
Right.
Senator Woodward, do you have anything on that one?
One specific action I know that is happening is using the funds from the Volkswagen settlement, where Volkswagen had essentially a cheater on their emissions, on their diesel emissions on some of their vehicles.
Totally a cheater.
Yeah. You hook up the diagnostic system and it changes the way the motor operates. Yes, I guess that's a cheater. And so as a result, Volkswagen has put a lot of money out in a penalty form for that. And the state of Idaho, I believe the number has about $17 million. So the idea, or the initiative, is to put in a travel corridors with charging stations, and so be able to get charging stations at proper spacing up and down Highway 95 and across the interstate I-84 and up and down I-15 so that we can travel around the state. On the wildfire issue, I'd add to that, on that Good Neighbor Authority that Representative Dixon was speaking about, that I think that's key. That's the Idaho agency, Idaho Department of Lands, managing timber sales on federal ground. The reason we need to get after that is in the last 30 years, timber sales off federal grounds are down 80%, and so we've built up fuel. We live within our environment here. We don't have there are enough people here now that I mean that we are a part of it, and we don't desire wildfires. Wildfires are a natural part of the cycle, but we'd rather manage a little bit so that we don't have to live with the effects of those wildfires. And so we will need to get back out there on those federal grounds where most of these fires have happened, and we can do it with our good neighbor authority. The next step in that, which we're talking with IDL to make this happen, is that to get some of that funding turned back to the schools and local road authorities, county road and bridge departments, like we used to do about 30 years ago, when we did not talk about supplemental levies at the schools. That's what's gone, is that we don't have the tax base that other places have because we have a lot of federal ground, but we did have, instead of that tax base, income from federal timber sales.
Yeah, payment in lieu of taxes.
Well, that was a stopgap after the timber industry started to go away.
And
the
timber, that's true.
Payment in lieu of taxes and secure rural schools, PILT and SRS, were federal monies coming probably from general fund to make up, to band-aid the problem that the timber sales were down. The timber sales were down because we saw a swing in attitude about treatment of federal grounds.
Well, we have to move on. The headlines in the Idaho Statesman this morning were Idaho Dems walk out of hearing for bill that would alter redistricting committee makeup. And a little background on that. Currently, districts for Congress and the state legislature are drawn every 10 years by a 6-member commission in Idaho, answerable only to the courts. The majority and the minority party leaders in each legislative chamber select one person to serve on the commission. The state chair of the Republican and Democratic parties also select a commissioner, and commissioners cannot be government officials or lobbyists. At least 2/3 of the commissioners must approve a redistricting map. Now, I've never heard that Idaho is known as a super gerrymandered state. However, on Wednesday, February 6th, the House State Affairs Committee proposed a resolution to put before the voters an amendment to the Constitution, and they're calling it HJR2, related to changing the makeup of the commission that I just described for reapportionment. If passed, this change to the Constitution would potentially dramatically change the makeup of the currently balanced nonpartisan commission that determines voting. What they basically are putting in this proposal to change the Constitution, that it would not be equal, it could be 3 and 4. So to add one person to the makeup of the commission. It's also noted that in order for something like this to go through, an amendment is agreed to by 2/3 of the members of both House, State Senate, and the Idaho House of Representatives. And the proposed amendment goes on the next general ballot if it's passed. And I'm pretty sure the governor has to also sign for it to get on the ballot. And then if it passes, the amendment becomes part of the Constitution. So the question becomes, this is the initial process. It's just in the House committee right now. If it went to the House, and it did pass Friday because the 3 Democrats walked out, the 10 Republicans sitting on the committee, the House, what are we calling it?
The State Affairs Committee,
voted unanimously to send it to the floor. So the question is, do you think this is good for Idaho? This change would be good for Idaho to determine voting districts by having it it's always been equal, 3 and 3. Do you think this could lead to gerrymandering? I really just really want to know your opinion of you think this is good for Idaho. Representative Dixon.
So knowing the gentleman who brought this bill, he's a very fair-minded individual. This isn't an effort to be able to gerrymander. And he was looking for a solution to the process that we go through every, it's 10 years whenever we do the redistricting, in that you would have a stalemate, there would be all kinds of accusations made, and then it would end up being the courts that would make the decision, not necessarily that commission, because you wouldn't have a majority. Because being equally bipartisan, each one is going to be struggling for their perspective on that. So rather than continually go through those costs of court and then having a court make the decision, this was an effort on his part to insert something where there's a concrete answer coming out of that redistricting commission. Now, that being said, there would still be a court case. It's just the way we do things these days. But that was his effort and ideal. And in making it our constitutional officers, except for the Secretary of State and Attorney General, because they both would be legally involved in the election process, that he saw that as a more accurate reflection on the will of the people, because the people in those offices would be elected by the majority of the state, not just representatives, if you will. So, yes, it can give rise to one perspective over another when you have that happening. But again, I don't think that it is his purpose to try and keep a Republican majority, because at this point it most likely would be a Republican. But those numbers are changing, especially in Ada County. I think the superintendent's race was probably a lot closer than we expected at that point, and perhaps even maybe not so much lieutenant governor. But I think there's some changes happening that may provide some balance as well. If you had a governor and lieutenant governor, but maybe you have from the other party, the treasurer and superintendent. So there would be hopefully a less partisan person that would be that seventh member of the commission. And I believe that was his intent. And looking at it, trying to make it as equitable as possible, but still have something that could be definitive coming out of that commission instead of the stalemate and accusations being thrown around in a court making the decision in the end. I would hope, well, it's hard. You hope everybody has the right intentions, but it's politics. And there's the opportunity to shape things the way you want it when you do redistricting. So I don't know if it would be explicitly be gerrymandering like we've seen in other states. Because of the size of our state, it's a little bit harder to do that. But down in Ada County and in Idaho Falls, where there's a lot of districts in one area, that can happen there.
I'm not up to speed on this issue, but this raises a question for me. Are there anyone in the legislature that is an independent, not affiliated with either party?
No, everybody is either a Republican or Democrat.
Because the question that came to my mind, well, okay, if you want to break that 3-3 tie, right, make that seventh seat an independent, so they could maybe see.
And I kind of had that discussion with a few people in the political world, not other legislators, somebody that works for the governor's office, somebody that works for the Professional Firefighters Organization. And can you find a truly independent person? But that's a difficult thing. We all have our worldview and our presuppositions that we bring to every conversation, and especially in politics. I mean, somebody could declare themselves an independent, but there's generally a tilt in one direction or another. That would be ideal. Mm-hmm. If you could find a truly independent party that may be able to take both sides, but it's difficult sometimes.
Mm-hmm. You know, especially in our hyper-partisan times we have.
Well, I'd like to hear from Senator Woodward about this same issue, the potential change that the House State Affairs Committee has put forward to now go to the House floor that would change the Commission for Reappropriament, the balance from 3-3 to 3-4, potentially.
I've not read the actual piece of legislation. I just read a newspaper article on that. And so to speak to the details, I'm not ready to do that, but I can say that I think that a balanced system is important to the state as a whole and for the long-term health of the state. And so I am a supporter of a 3-3 system that we have now, or some other system that's definitely balanced.
Okay. You know, I think we're about out of time here. I'm going to try to squeeze in one more little short question, because just yesterday a House Representatives Committee voted to introduce legislation to legalize the growth and transportation sale of hemp throughout the state. What do you guys think about the prospects of legalizing hemp as an agricultural product are coming out of this proposed legislation?
I'm in favor of it. I think that's great. I've poked around that for a couple of years. Farm Bureau is in favor of that. They see it as a viable crop. That was always my question, is if we're going to go to this length, is it truly something that people will grow? Is there commercial opportunity there? And they believe there is, and there's a larger national conversation growing. The hard thing for most people is THC levels. How much does it look like a marijuana plant? Can you easily identify hemp from marijuana if you've got a 30-acre field of it? That's going to be the difficult part in getting that through.
Okay.
And Senator Woodward just gave me a smile and said he's okay with it, too. Is that what you were going to say?
No, I was saying I was okay with that. If you didn't want to comment from me, if you're trying to finish up.
Well, we could move. Well, yeah, give us a one-minute comment. That would be great. Senator Woodward, on the hemp issue.
I am a believer that in the idea of gateway drugs. I know hemp is not a drug. Hemp is a material, but it does have some THC content. And it's 2019. I don't think we're at a shortage of materials to use for clothing or whatever other, or rope or anything else. So I don't think that there's a viable argument that we need it for industrial applications. So I'm not sure what the push is. If we don't need it for industrial or utility applications, then why do we need it?
I've heard the argument it's renewable and it's easy, it's cheap, and it's... That's just what I've heard over the time.
That's a valid point. My ears are still open.
I was still asking these questions, and I was given the answer that Canada has a large hemp industry, and we import a lot of it down here for certain materials. I agree with Senator Woodward, but that was always my question over and over. Why do we need to do this? Is it a viable commercial interest to go? It'll be difficult to get something like that through. So do we want to go through that exercise if nobody's really going to take advantage of it within our state? And apparently somebody thinks so. Mm-hmm. So here we go.
There we go. Okay, we'd like to each, again, thank you so much for coming in and continuing to communicate with your constituents here at KRFY over the airwaves. A closing statement, Senator Woodward, why don't you start, about a minute and a half.
Well, thanks for the opportunity to be here. I have had a lot of great conversations in the last 5 weeks with a lot of people from the district. We've talked with loggers, doctors, every different the Medicaid expansion supporters have been down to Boise. The county folks have been down from Bonner and Boundary County, the city of Sandpoint. It's always great to see somebody down in the Capitol and get a one-on-one interaction, especially when there's something that needs to be taken care of. The phone works, email works. It's definitely the way the system should work, is that we're just carrying your thoughts and voices down there. So I appreciate the conversation and appreciate the support of everyone.
And Representative Dixon.
Thank you. I appreciate you giving us this opportunity again. It's nice and good questions. Good to talk about this. Just to echo what Senator Woodward said, it's really nice to hear from people in our district. And even if we don't always agree, it's good to get that information. So the Reclaim Idaho people, great conversation that we had last week. They know where I'm on this, but it was a good conversation. And then I met with some folks from Head Start, the early Head Start. And that was a great conversation, too, to hear how that program has been helping people in our district, and that was very encouraging, actually. I learned a lot. So those are critical things, and I know it's difficult for us to get down there, people from our district anyway, and to speak to the representatives. I'm not so good with the phone. Emails I get back eventually, but it's still good to get that input, because we do read all those things, and it helps us make decisions that help our district and to balance them with our principles that we told you we'd have when we were elected. And so that's part of what we do in representing everybody in this district.
And a shout out to Julie Smith and the FFA chapter up in Bonner's Ferry. If people are listening up there, they came down to the Capitol. We had a great time.
Yes.
Both Representative Dixon and I.
Yes.
The FFA chapter, that's a great group of young people.
Yes.
And a shout out to you guys for helping keep PISNY strong here, Panel Special Needs. That's the why we send you guys down there.
It's always rewarding when we can do something specific like that. Mm-hmm. That's good.
Well, thank you very much.